Hello and welcome to our podcast. Today we have the distinct honor to have Dr. Andrea Bradford, who is an associate professor at Baylor College of Medicine. She is also the clinical health psychologist specializing in the care of patients with digestive diseases. She is editor-in-chief of clinical psychology. And we are indeed honored to have you here today. Dr. Bradford, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I will start. Most of us who see gastroenterology patients wish we had somebody like you on staff to refer our patients to, because as you know, stress plays a major part in some patients with functional symptoms. And clearly, sometimes patients tell us their symptoms are worse when they're stressed or when they're having a hard time in their life, and they go on vacation and they feel much better, and they come back and their symptoms start to get worse again. So what should people with GI conditions know about how stress can affect their symptoms?
That's a great question. When people notice that stress affects their gut, it might be risky feeling to share this information with their doctor because people don't want their symptoms to be dismissed. So it's understandable that someone might be a little reluctant to share that, you know, when I got this bad news, all of a sudden my heartburn just really went through the roof, or when I go on vacation, it goes away, because they don't want to be seen as having their symptoms be all in their head, and they don't want their symptoms to be dismissed, or, you know, for their doctor not to take them seriously. So there are real reasons why somebody might be reluctant to share those observations. But what people should know is that we don't consider those kinds of symptoms to be all in a person's head, or psychogenic, as some people might say. But rather, there really is this true interaction between brain and gut that each affects the other's functioning and physiology. So for example, one simple example is when you're under a great deal of stress, it tends to affect the motility of your gut, such that your stomach might empty more slowly than usual. This could even potentially provide a false positive on a gastric emptying test. It can also change the motility of the colon so that you become either really bloated and constipated because things have really slowed down, or sometimes you might get spasms and have diarrhea because the motility of the colon has changed in the opposite direction. But in the same way, the gut function can also affect the brain. We're just beginning to understand how, for example, the microbiome might influence a person's mood or anxiety or other mental health related conditions. We don't know as much about that clinically to be able to act on it and prescribe treatment. But I think what's important to know is that there's this complex interplay between the brain and the gut, and they depend on each other. If you didn't have a brain, your gut would function very differently than it does. And likewise, if you didn't have your gut and all of the microbiome inside, your brain would probably function quite differently as well. So these symptoms are not all in somebody's head. But rather that influence of stress on gut function is really part of this complex back and forth communication between brain and gut.
Wow. And I know that we tend to get into the habit of just relying on antispasmodics and FODMAP diets and what have you to try and help people with symptoms. And we're not really seeing the whole picture, as you've just pointed out. So what kinds of treatments seem to help patients who have symptoms that are clearly sensitive to stress by their history?
When we see patients who are interested in behavioral or psychological treatment, we tend to use a couple of different modalities, and it really depends on what's going on in that person's life and the pattern that they've noticed. So, for example, people who notice that anytime they get stressed or they've lost a little bit of sleep the night prior, That their symptoms get a lot worse. Often people respond quite well to incorporating some relaxation techniques into their routine. And essentially, that's helping them to train their body out of getting into that stress response so easily. As humans, we're really good at becoming stressed. It's part of our survival instincts, our survival mechanism. We're really good at getting into the stress response, but we tend not to be as skilled at getting out of it. So when we're in that high stress response, it affects the functioning of your gut. And again, that can be just something that happens almost outside of conscious awareness. But getting out of it, getting back to neutral, back to homeostasis, takes a little more work and effort. So a lot of folks respond quite well to relaxation training, and that can take the form of doing certain breathing techniques that you do for at least 5 to 10 minutes. Certain muscle relaxation techniques, and even clinical hypnosis, which is a way of providing a very deep relaxation response, paired with some other suggestions that we provide to help patients think about and even sometimes visualize their gut functioning differently and becoming less sensitive to pain and upset. That's one category. Another category of interventions is what we could broadly call behavioral therapy. And this is for patients who can maybe put more of a box around some of the things that are especially stressful to them. So, for example, they might have a lot of difficulty going out into social situations, or going to restaurants or outdoor places where they can't necessarily guarantee that they might have access to a restroom or to a place where they can have some privacy. And so if they are concerned about their bowel function and whether that might start to become a problem, like what if I get bad intestinal cramps while I'm out at a festival, then they can start to avoid those activities. And that avoidance in the short term provides some relief. You don't have to go and face this situation that might become very uncomfortable or painful or awkward for you. But it comes at a cost, of course. Your world gets a little bit smaller as a result of avoiding things that might put you in an uncomfortable situation. And that can become a vicious circle, and people's worlds can get smaller and smaller and smaller. And as a result of that, people lose a sense of self-efficacy about what they can take on, the kinds of situations they can manage with their disease, and it starts to feel like the disease is in the or the condition is in the driver's seat rather than all the other things that go into our decision making about where we go and how we spend our time. So behavior therapy is really focused on helping people to develop more workable coping strategies for those kinds of situations. That might be, for example, being a little more assertive about the fact that you may have a need to take a break now and then, or you might want some input into, where you go and what's on the menu. Or it may be developing that sense that I have maybe more control over this and more ability to manage this than I feel sometimes. And even gently pushing the envelope a little bit of your comfort zone to prove to yourself that, yes, you do have more control than you think you might in many situations, so you can get back to enjoying a fuller life. None of this takes the place of any kind of medical treatment or dietary management that somebody might be receiving concurrently. In fact, I encourage people with digestive diseases to really take all of those into consideration, their medical treatment and making sure that that's working for them and it's something they can adhere to. Their dietary management, and again, if there's something that's really hard to adhere to, have an open discussion with the dietitian and don't feel like you need to be extremely rigid about something that may or may not be helping you. But hitting on all of those different aspects of your treatment, your medical, your dietary, your behavioral health, when all of those are aligned, then again, that gives people a sense of control and ability to manage. And it doesn't necessarily take away all the flare-ups or symptoms, but just having a more of a sense of predictability about what that might look like if that does come up. So behavior therapy is around the thoughts, but also the behaviors, and how to cope when those difficult situations do arise or when symptoms flare up.
Well, we're very lucky that we have you, a GI psychologist, in our clinic setting. And we all know how difficult and frustrating it can be to try and manage people on just medications and reassurance. And so what would you say to a clinics where a psychologist is not available easily, but patients you think will benefit from seeing a GI psychologist? What options do they have if they don't have access to somebody like yourself?
Well, a lot of the strategies that I use are adapted from strategies that are used in other areas of psychology. So if there is a psychologist that you feel comfortable referring to and establishing a relationship, it may be a matter of picking up the phone and explaining what the patients are needing, and trying to see if the psychologist or mental health provider can sort of meet you halfway, even if they don't specialize in GI conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So having somebody who's willing to work with you and establish some back and forth communication in itself can be helpful. There are also some telehealth practices that serve multiple states now that do specialize in GI psychology. And I'm not going to name names right now, but if there are folks who contact you and would like to contact me by way of this podcast, I'm happy to share some recommendations. Since the pandemic, especially, obviously, telemedicine has really taken off. And in mental health, that has been probably a stronger, longer lasting trend than in any other area of medicine. And several telemedicine practices have sprung up over the years. And we typically cannot practice psychology or other mental health professions across state lines. But for psychologists, there have been some policy changes where multiple states will recognize another state's licensure. So there are now some practices that serve multiple states. And that's really great because that means that this more specialized expertise can have a much wider reach.
Very useful information. Now, you know, I know that in our GI fellowships, we, until recently, haven't really been trained very well in the need for having psychologists on board with the gut-brain axis, with probiotics and the microbiome. And this is all very new now. A lot of gastroenterologists, especially those who've trained, you know, several decades ago, might be skeptical about how much this helps. We know it helps a lot. It can make the major difference between helping a patient and leaving them frustrated. What are some of the misconceptions about your work as a psychologist in the GI clinic do you come across?
Yeah, so I think one of the misconceptions is this idea of psychogenesis, like these symptoms are all in a person's head, and that's kind of how we think about them and how we approach them. So this is why, you know, we encourage gastroenterologists or any referring clinician to think of this as a partnership early on when there is a signal that maybe somebody could benefit from having this kind of support in addition to their medical care. What we don't want is for somebody to be on third or fourth line treatment, and then the provider is sort of out of options and then says, well, maybe you should see a psychologist. It's really demoralizing for the patient, but it also puts the psychologist in a challenging position because things probably could have worked differently had that partnership been in place earlier on. But the symptoms that somebody has when they're in chronic pain or When they're experiencing, recurring abdominal cramping, heartburn, et cetera, they're perceived in the brain, but they're not being generated from the brain. And being able to work with somebody like that, sorry, I misspoke. The symptoms that someone has when they're provoked by stress are not being generated in the brain. They're perceived in the brain, of course, as we perceive everything that happens in our bodies, but they're not coming from the brain, and they're not motivated by a sense of wanting to be sick or wanting to be ill or incapacitated in some way. So we're not looking for people to have, hidden motives or deep unconscious drives that are causing them to be sick. That's not what this is about. So I think that for patients to hear that, to know that your symptoms are real, and we're going to just look at the other half of the system that is driving some of this, I think is a much more workable way to approach this than thinking that, well, I'm going to go get my head shrunk and somebody's going to, ask me about my mother, and somehow that's going to point to why I have IBS. That's not how this works, not at all. The other misconception is that this is always about somebody's mental illness. Many of my patients don't really meet criteria for a mental disorder. They don't necessarily have depression or anxiety. And if people have a severe mental disorder that's not being managed appropriately, it's actually usually better for them to seek care and stabilize, for example, a severe depression or PTSD or something like that, to have that stabilized before they start working on these brain-gut interactions. So typically my role is first, when I'm seeing someone for the first time, to establish their mental health history and to make sure that they have resources to get help if there is an untreated mental disorder. Because often it's the case that someone may have no mental health history or no mental disorder, and they can still benefit from these services.
I can see that this is so critical to successful management of some of our patients that we see. Are most of these referrals covered by insurance? I'm just curious, or do they pay out of pocket when they come to see you?
Most people come to see me, most people who come to see me are using their insurance benefits. Insurance coverage for mental health services is better than it used to be. There are some laws now that require parity, meaning an equivalent level of benefit for mental health services and for the rest of their health services. However, there are a number of loopholes by which certain plans can get out of that requirement. So, for example, many self-funded plans, in other words, your company actually pays for your health services and they just hire a company to administer those benefits. There are some loopholes like that where companies do not have to cover mental health treatment. So there are some exceptions to this, and it makes it more difficult to access mental health services. Also, we don't always contract with certain plans because they reimburse so little for mental health services. I remember a colleague of mine in private practice was explaining one of the reasons she didn't accept a certain type of insurance was because they hadn't changed their reimbursement rates since the 1980s. And she just couldn't, that wasn't sustainable for maintaining a practice. So there are the situation with mental health coverage in the United States is still pretty patchy. One real exception to that, fortunately, is Medicare. Medicare provides excellent coverage for mental health services, and I've never had a problem with Medicare before.
Awesome. That's very useful information. Well, I'm glad that we got to meet with you and have this discussion, because there is a gap of missing information with a lot of us gastroenterologists, particularly those that have trained a while ago to look at the importance of stress in our patient symptoms. And I'm delighted that we got to have this conversation that's provided some very useful information. And what we will do is at the end of this chat, we will include some links to the internet for resources for people who are interested in pursuing this further.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Hopefully we'll meet again and talk about some different aspect in the near future.
Sounds great.
Thank you. Bye-bye.